From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch is making the rounds on Capitol Hill today, visiting with senators who will vote on his nomination. We're getting reaction from across the political spectrum. Republicans generally very happy with the pick. Joining us now is Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse, senator from Rhode Island, who is on the Judiciary Committee. Senator, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, what are your thoughts on Neil Gorsuch?
My primary thought is to determine whether he is truly a judicially conservative judge or whether he is a politically conservative activist in robes. And it's a very, very important distinction because we saw during the Robert Scalia era a 5-4 all the Republicans lined up together, barrage of decisions that were far from judicially conservative, but served the politically conservative goals of Republican election interests and big business corporate interests and the right-wing social agenda. And determining whether Gorsuch would follow that lead and rebuild that five-judge activist block, I think, is the fundamental question for me.
But is there a possibility that you would vote for him?
I hold out eternal hope. I think that the power of the special interests who not only dominate the fundraising for the Republican Party, but also appear all the time in front of the court, makes the likelihood that he'll be a truly independent judicial conservative pretty small. But I want to explore that in the hearings. I think it's a danger if we simply rebuild the Gang of Five that ran so roughshod over so many principles in order to serve the big Republican special interests.
Well, some of your Democratic colleagues think that Republicans stole this Supreme Court seat from President Obama because they would not allow a hearing on his pick, Merrick Garland, for the last year of his presidency. Do you believe that?
Well, certainly they were way out of the traditional order of the Senate in preventing Merrick Garland from taking the seat and blocking President Obama's nominee. And now they're in a position to capitalize on that, which is yet another reason. If you add up how much they were willing to take in the way of public displeasure about what they were doing, they were obviously doing that for a reason. You don't just take hits like that unless there's some gain to be had. So the idea that this is not going to be a politically active judge when you see him be the product of such a partisan political effort to preserve the seat, plus you're seeing special interest money lining up to create a political campaign to get him confirmed. So all the signals are that he's not going to be a true judicial conservative. He instead is going to be another politically conservative activist and rebuild that 5-4 block that I think has been so bad for our country and for, you know, regular people.
So why not filibuster his nomination then?
Well, I do think we're going to insist on 60 votes. I think the Republicans would have insisted on 60 votes were the shoe on the other foot. And if they want to blow up the supermajority requirement for a Supreme Court judge, then we'll have to deal with that as it comes.
For our listeners who may not know much about Neil Gorsuch, and actually on some of the big issues, we don't know exactly what he believes because he hasn't had to rule on them before. But do you think that the issue of abortion, that the issue of same-sex marriage could come up before the court if Gorsuch is confirmed and that the law of the land could change as a result?
There are a lot of people and a lot of very powerful interests that look at the court and see it as an opportunity to claim political ground. And they are backing this nominee because they think they can use him to claim that political ground. So forces that want to do a woman's right to self-determination as to her own reproductive processes very much want to use the court to achieve that political aim. The few people left who I think still resent the progress that we've made with respect to gay and lesbian couples and marriage and all of that, I think see the court as a tool to get around popular support for that, get around the challenges of coming out legislatively against our gay community so viciously, and just have somebody on the court who will undo things. So it has to be watched out for, and there are all these signals of these powerful right-wing forces pushing for it that suggests that there's an ulterior motive here. This is all about being able to call in their agenda once he's on the court, and they'll be very disappointed if Gorsuch won't do that.
Senator, it sounds like from what you're saying and from what some of your colleagues are saying that you may not vote for Gorsuch, but it could have been worse from your perspective. Is that fair?
Remains to be seen. I think that lasting and severe damage was done to this country by those five Republican judges acting politically, acting as activists, and in some really significant ways, dramatically degrading American democracy. And if this person, no matter how appealing his academic credentials are, is going to go back and renew that, then I think we've got a real problem on our hands in this country.
That's Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, President Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Veterans Affairs Department will be on Capitol Hill today. Dr. David Shulkin is currently the VA's top health official. He'll testify before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. He could become the first Obama administration holdover in the Trump cabinet and the first non-veteran to head the VA. He'll lead an agency, if he's confirmed, described by Donald Trump as the most corrupt and probably the most incompetently run. And it did see that 2014 scandal with veterans waiting months for care and employees in Phoenix, for instance, covering that up. Paul Rykoff is an Iraq War veteran and founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Let's check in with Paul. Paul, what do you and your members want to hear from Dr. Shulkin today?
Well, Robin, I think the first thing we want to hear is, how are you going to handle this? This is one of the biggest messes in Washington. Being the VA secretary might be the second hardest job in the Capitol. And our veterans have been through a lot, especially over the last 15 years of war. So we want to know how this guy's going to handle it. Why can we trust you? How are you going to take care of our brothers and sisters around the country? And especially in these tough political times, this has been a bit below the radar. You know, there's so much other news happening, but this is a 300,000 person agency. It's $180 billion budget. So this is a massive responsibility, and we want to know how he's going to handle it.
Well, as you well know, there are calls to dismantle the agency, to at least have wide-scale firings. Donald Trump has a 10-point plan to reform the VA, and part of that is more privatizing, more private care for veterans. Start with that. Do you want to tear it apart? Do you want to privatize it?
Yeah, that's exactly what we want to ask Secretary Shulkin today, because, you know, his public comments in his prior role seem to be a bit out of line with where President Trump has been. And our members, we've been polling them online, and they've been submitting questions on Twitter. The number one question they want to know is, where does Secretary Shulkin stand, or potential Secretary Shulkin stand, on privatization? Most veterans are happy with the quality of their care. The access to care stinks. And they don't want full privatization, but they want to know what kind of integrated solution they can come up with. We don't want someone who's going to come in and blow it all up and just burn the whole thing down. And that's why IAVA has been pleased with a moderate nominee here. It could have been much worse. And IAVA and other veterans groups worked hard to ensure that this pick was someone who could potentially create some continuity and be a moderate voice of reason in extremely political times.
Well, Shulkin has sent those signals that he's not about tearing it completely apart. But talk about one of the things, you know, some of the things that you would like to see. What are the small things that would help? I mean, because we are hearing that veterans like yourself would prefer to keep your treatment at the VA and VA medical centers, which might be better suited to battlefield injuries or post-traumatic stress. So what could fix things like the wait times?
Yeah, well, I don't think there are any little things at the VA. That's part of the challenge, is making that big battleship move is extremely difficult. What we hear from our members that we want him to tackle maybe most of all is the suicide rate. This is about people. We are losing 20 veterans every day to suicide, and we've been asking for questions from members. And one question that someone posted today is from a father who lost his son. And he said, over the last 12 years, since our son died by suicide, while we sought help from the VA, what have you done. Not actually talked, but done to make the VA truly responsive to our veterans' needs while so many others stood by while thousands and tens of thousands continued to kill themselves. Well, so how are you going to save our lives?
Yeah. Well,
that's the stakes here that I think everybody really wants him to focus
on.
Well,
right now, 20 lives a day, unacceptable. And in his prepared testimony, Dr. Shulkin is citing efforts by the Obama administration, hiring more psychologists and psychiatrists and trying to cut that number down. But as you said, you want to hear more. He's the first non-veteran to lead the VA. Does that bother you? He could be. Does that bother you?
It's a huge concern for many of our members. Some don't care, but a majority do. It is unprecedented, so we're going to have to hear from him why he should be the first non-veteran to ever lead VA in history. We also need to hear from President Trump. You know, why couldn't you find someone in the 22 million veteran population nationwide? The VA secretary is not just an administrator, but he's also America's lead veterans advocate. Yeah. So it's very important for Shulkin today to convince us that he can represent us, even though he's not one of us.
Well, he is the son of an Army psychiatrist and a grandson of a VA pharmacist, so perhaps he can. Paul Rykoff, founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin, as always.
Yesterday's decision to provide up to 900 waivers to refugees who'd been banned for 120 days under President Trump's orders does not help the refugees in the second 90-day ban against those coming from seven Muslim-majority countries. That includes Somali refugees who'd fled the terrorist group al-Shabaab into a Kenyan refugee camp. Many had given up their tents and supplies and were about to board planes when the news came that after years of vetting, they were barred. Let's get some context. Abdi Samad is a professor and chair at the University of Minnesota's Department of Geography, Environment, and Society. He joins us by Skype. Professor, welcome.
Pleasure to be with you, Robin.
What is happening in Somalia?
Well, the first thing is that Somalia is an orphan of the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union played havoc with the lives of that country, which ultimately led its own collapse. That drove thousands, hundreds of thousands of Somalis into the neighboring states, one of which was Kenya, where you had their largest refugee camp in a place called Dadaab. So really, if you look back at it, the United States, much like in Iraq and in Afghanistan, is politically and morally implicated in the disaster that's that country. And therefore, in my assessment, we owe them at least some modicum of support so that they can put their country back together, which we have not been doing very well.
Well, and there are many aid groups in the U.S. who completely agree with you, and we have been bringing Somali refugees in, towns in Vermont, Minnesota, where you are. How many Somali refugees have come?
Over the years, I think probably 100,000 Somalis are in the United States, maybe a shade bigger than that in Canada, and about the same size, maybe a little bit more in the United Kingdom. So they are all over the place.
Well, and what are the chances? Look, the Guardian is quoting a mother of five in the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya who said, I did all the interviews and all the screenings needed for refugees, including security, health checks. I was told that I and my children will be going to Arizona, but now I have no hope because of Donald Trump's order. What are the chances that someone would be coming from 8 years in a Kenyan refugee camp and would be affiliated with a terrorist organization as opposed to being a mother of five who escaped terror in Somalia?
I think all the evidence and the data we have point out that those who are affiliated with al-Shabaab, if you like, or other terrorist groups, are not refugees. I think something to the order of 95% of those who have committed terrorist acts, either in Europe or here, are not refugees. And so what we are doing is we are using a jackhammer to get something small on the surface of the planet. I think we have destroyed those countries. I mean, Iraq, there were no terrorists. There was no Al-Qaeda, but there was a dictator. So our wisdom told us that we have to get rid of the dictator, disband the army in that country, which was the fortress against Al-Qaeda. So the very people who are fleeing from terrorists are being told that you could not find refuge here because where you live, there are terrorists. And so it just doesn't make any sense. I think the president and his team could have been much more careful in vetting, saying, people, if you were vetted before and you have gone through 2 years, give us another 2 months to work through this. What this does, in my opinion, is to reinforce the ideas that al-Shabaab and others have been propagating, that the United States is at war with Muslims.
Well, but Professor, others have, you know, made not only that argument, but others. They've said, why not ban people coming from countries where people have caused terror in the U.S., for instance, the Pakistani wife of the San Bernardino shooter? Why not ban people from Pakistan? But what do you say to people, Professor, who say these Somalis may have fled terror, but many of their children were converted to terrorist organizations while in the U.S.? We know that young Somalis left Minnesota to try to join terrorist organizations. People are afraid of that.
Of course, I mean, that's a legitimate concern, but I think we need to put all the facts on the table. I teach here at the University of Minnosota. We have about 700 to 800 Somali students at different levels of the graduate, undergraduate programs. All of them are very good students, getting on with their work. At some point, some of these graduates were the largest number of sort of engineers for working IBM here in Minnesota. And so I think we have to go after the individual who are criminals. The vast majority of Somalis, over 99% who have come here as refugees, are doing well, are superb citizens, support neighbors, stay out of crime. And so to be penalized is exactly what this country has gotten away from. Blanket sort of a description of communities on the basis of individual criminals.
Yeah,
in that, in my mind, is against the values of the country and against the Constitution of the United States.
In some areas where there are refugees, local officials say they actually have a lower crime rate than other populations. Look, al-Shabaab, the terrorist group that drove these refugees from Somalia into Kenya, attacked a hotel in Mogadishu, killed at least 28 people last week, attacked a Kenyan military base in Somalia, killing 60 soldiers. But we understand Kenya is thinking of closing these refugee camps. What will happen to these Somali refugees?
Well, I mean, many of them will have no choice but either to move further afield into the heart of Africa or to go back to their country. I think one of the ways in which we can support those refugees to go back to their country is to provide the kind of resources so that the regime in Mogadishu, which is incredibly corrupt and which we have supported, gets its house in order, and that the international community begins to put resources in developing Somali security forces that will replace the Kenyans and the Burundians and what have you, so that there is a 10 to 15,000 Somali security forces professional enough. We can train that in a year or two, and they will drive al-Shabaab into the sea. For me, that's the most certain way to support the refugees to go back their home and rebuild their country.
Abdi Samatar, professor at the University of Minnesota's Department of Geography, Environment, and Society. Professor, thank you.
With pleasure.
Well, Nike and Adidas have both condemned President Trump's bans on travel from countries including Somalia, in part because of the possible impact on the world of sports. Nike CEO Mark Parker mentioned runner Mo Farah, a four-time Olympic gold medal winner born in Somalia, now a citizen of Britain, training right now in Ethiopia, worried about getting home to family in Oregon. He's a symbol of the fluidity of international sports. He wrote on Facebook, "On January 1st, the Queen made me a knight of the realm. This week, Donald Trump seems to have made me an alien." Well, it turns out Farah won't be affected by the ban on Somalians because he only holds citizenship now in Britain. But what about the marathoners? There are many from Iran, Syria, and Sudan. The NBA's Basketball Without Borders camp is scheduled for the All-Star weekend in February. And then there are the Iranian weightlifters. Phil Andrews is CEO of USA Weightlifting. He joins us by Skype from Colorado Springs. And Phil, this has us thinking that one of the most striking things to come from this is that people are realizing how many Iranians travel between the U.S. and Iran, including weightlifters.
Yes, we attend championships in Iran. They host the IWF Grand Prix. The Iranian team come here. We have an exceptional relationship with the Iranian Federation. We're due to compete there in March, and they're due to come here in November of this year for the World Championships in Anaheim, California.
Well, again, we're finding out, you know, some are finding out that weightlifters, wrestlers, your fellow athletes, go to Iran. We understand they're greeted there, you know, heroically. How are they treated there?
Exceptionally well. I mean, they're like guests in your house. I think because there is strained relations between the nations, there's an extra effort made to make sure that the U.S. citizens feel very welcome in Iran in a sporting event. And we're the same way when they come here.
But do you understand the concern that somebody might, recognizing that these people, there's a relationship and people travel freely, somebody might want to insinuate themselves into this who, you know, might be bent on a terrorist act? I mean, I think it's hard to imagine somebody would be able to pass themselves off as a world-class athlete, you know, without others in the field noticing. But there is a concern that it's just too porous.
Well, it would be exceptionally difficult to do so, because in order to do that, you would have to, A, become a world-class athlete at that sport, B, you would have to escape the scrutiny that comes with a world-level event, with the television coverage, with the media coverage that comes with that. It seems very unlikely, especially with the extensive background checks. As a former visa holder and green card holder myself, I've been through them. I am not going to say it's impossible, but it certainly seems very unlikely, especially with the stringent controls and excellent controls that the Department of Homeland Security already place upon people coming to the U.S. And those are absolutely correct to put on.
Well, and you just mentioned you've been through this yourself. You recently became an American citizen. You're from the U.K.
That's correct.
And so this must resonate with you personally.
It does. I recently completed my citizenship. Two members of my team here are both on green cards. And it's personal because, you know, I know these people from these federations, not necessarily every athlete, but certainly the federation heads, and I speak on a regular basis. And it's difficult to explain what's going on. However, I am remaining confident and alongside them that they'll be permitted to compete in November, because it's well after the 90 days ban. And recently, the U.S. Open in Las Vegas for Taekwondo, an Iranian-born athlete was permitted to cross the border and compete. They were competing for Iceland, but they were permitted to come here and compete even during the 90-day ban.
So you have some hope.
I certainly do, and I think everyone is working towards the same goal of being able to continue to host world championship-level events in the United States. And that means a lot to us and all those who have a significant populations of athletes in those seven countries.
That's Phil Andrews, CEO of USA Weightlifting. Phil, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
The Army Corps of Engineers has been told to greenlight construction of the last stretch of the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's the part that goes under the Missouri River upstream of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Hundreds of tribe members, environmentalists, and others protested the pipeline for months last year until, in December, President Obama told the Army Corps to halt construction. The Army Corps at the time called for an environmental impact statement, which would take months, but now the Trump administration is saying, get on with it. Lee Patterson from Here and Now contributor Inside Energy has been covering the pipeline for months. She joins us now. And Lee, what's the status right now? Is the company back at work yet?
Well, so Jeremy, here's what we do know. Last night, North Dakota's congressional delegation said basically that the Army Corps is in the process of granting the easement. And this morning, in a statement, the Army Corps said that it is taking initial steps, but was very clear that those steps do not mean that the easement has been approved. So it's sort of at this point unclear when that will happen. But the key is that construction cannot proceed until that key easement is granted. And that's because the easement gives the company, called Energy Transfer Partners, permission to build the pipeline underneath Lake Oahe. And that, of course, has been the controversial part this whole time.
And remind us of the controversy about this pipeline. What are people so opposed to?
Well, there are kind of several answers to that question. So if we're talking about the Standing Rock Sioux, the tribe whose reservation is close to where the pipeline crosses, those folks are worried that the pipeline construction would damage areas that they consider to be sacred. They're also concerned that if this pipeline breaks, it would contaminate their drinking water. Now, the protests, of course, have been there have been a lot of different interests involved. There are environmental groups who basically see this fight as, you know, an anti-big oil fight, an anti-climate change fight. So the concerns are broad, but the Standing Rock Sioux are the folks who have been protesting the longest. They're the ones who live close to the site. They have a variety of concerns related to environment and really cultural heritage.
And there are still hundreds of protesters at the site, and the Standing Rock Sioux tribe has vowed to fight this. What's the plan for those opposed?
Yeah, so there are still a few hundred protesters left at the camp, and they had actually started cleaning up over the past few days. But of course, the Standing Rock Sioux, the tribe, they've issued a statement last night saying, you know, they're disappointed, but not entirely surprised. President Trump, this has always been his indication on the type of action that his administration would take. And other, you know, environmental activists have weighed in, too. The Indigenous Environmental Network has said that President Trump is doing what's best for business and is willing to put profit before human rights.
So what are the chances that construction will be stopped before it starts again?
So the tribe has promised to take legal action if the easement is granted. And again, the easement has not been granted yet. And what the tribe wants, what the Standing Rock Sioux want, is to make sure that a full environmental review, that environmental impact statement you referred to, an EIS, is completed before any decisions are made. So assuming that the tribe does go to court, the future of this pipeline could really be up to a judge.
That's Lee Patterson, who is a reporter with Here and Now contributor Inside Energy. Lee, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Well, there are Chinese New Year celebrations happening around the world this week, so we thought we'd do a Chinese music edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Joining us today is Dr. Mei Han, director of the Center for Chinese Music and Culture at Middle Tennessee State University. She's also a musician and joins us from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you have some contemporary Chinese music for us, a range of styles, a lot of it with traditional influences. So let's get right to it. This is the piece Five Heroes by Han Gai. Now, we've got some Mongolian throat singing going on there, don't we?
Yes. Actually, there are two types of throat singing going on. One is called overtone, which you hear harmonics, but also undertone, which is the sound that comes from chest. You usually hear this in Tibetan monk chanting.
So tell us more about Han Gai.
Well, Han Gai is a group of musicians that born and raised in Inner Mongolia, but they started this group in Beijing, actually. And these young people have learned a lot from Western punk, rock, and pop songs. So they wanted to combine these elements they learned from Western music and to their traditional music. What's interesting is growing up in Mongolia, or Inner Mongolia, I should say, the young people are not necessarily familiar with their traditional culture. So in order to be able to sing in Mongolian language, they had to learn their traditional language. So politically, culturally, this is a very interesting thing. You know, you find your identity through your music journey and reconnect to your motherland.
All right, well, let's get to the next one you wanted us to hear. This is from a group based in China. This is the Jasmine Ensemble with Nurturing Rain.
Thank you.
Now, what instrument is this we're listening to?
This is a hammer dulcimer.
Which is what exactly?
It's a box zither. Actually, Appalachian Mountain has a similar hammer dulcimer. And both instruments came from same family, which was originated in Middle East. It's called a centaur. And this ensemble is based in Beijing. It's a group of students led by their professor. And this is a brand new album, just came out last year, 2016.
So as we mentioned, it's Chinese New Year. Does music play a significant role in some of the celebrations?
Yes. Chinese music plays two kinds of roles. One is the CCTV puts out a spring gala on the New Year's Eve. This has been a tradition for almost 30 years. And every family, everybody, I would say, in China watches this show.
Wow.
And mostly it's music. And also, if you go to a market, go to a temple, you always have either live music performance or the music background.
Okay, well, up next, we've got another piece out of China. This is from the artist Li Yundi. It's called Pi Huang. And this is Li Yundi, by the way, one of the most well-known Chinese piano players, correct?
That's correct. He lives in China, but he's touring around the world. And Pi Huang is a melody that used in Beijing opera. And what is interesting in this is the combination of classical, you know, Western classical music with traditional Chinese melody. And to Chinese ear, this sounds very Chinese. I don't know if Western listeners would have the same reaction.
It definitely sounds a little bit different than just classical piano that we might hear from this country.
Right. And a lot of very colorful harmony, which is not necessarily, typical to classical music.
Well, my father is a classical pianist and actually spends a fair amount of time performing in China. I know that classical music is very big in China.
Yes, yes, especially in the since the mid-20th century. Western music was brought to China after the Opium War in 1840 and became big in the early 20th century. After 1980, a middle-class Chinese family, almost every single family I know has a piano, owns the piano. And my daughter started learning piano when she was four. It's almost like a pressure that the society put on.
Well, let's get to the last one. This is called Tan Tan Chang Chang by Min Xiaofen. It almost sounds like she's playing a banjo there.
It's Chinese san xian. San means three. Xian means string. So three string. It's a fretless lute. It does sound like a banjo because of the sound box is covered by snake skin.
And tell us a little more about her and about this piece.
Yeah, Min Xiaofen was born in Nanjing. It's just outside of Shanghai. She came to New York 20 years ago, and drawn by all kinds of traditional music that from this part of the world, especially blues. So in this piece, you will hear at the beginning, the intro, a lot of we call it a blues note. And I asked her what was the influence. She said, I listened to all kinds of music, Miles Davis, all blues. And Tan Tan Chang Chang is one of the tracks of her CD called Dim Sum. And Tan is to plug in Chinese. Chang is to sing. So she combines singing and plucking, meaning performing the instruments together. You know, in China, a lot of people are trained to do one thing. You are either an instrumentalist or you are a singer. And people like her can sing, can play. Is very rare.
And now you've got us all thinking about dim sum, and now we're hungry.
Okay. And we don't have any Chinese food here in Murfreesboro. Not real Chinese food.
Well, Dr. Mei Han, Director of the Center for Chinese Music and Culture at Middle Tennessee State University, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. 恭喜发财.
This is Here and Now.
President Trump has been gathering Americans around a table to lay out his agenda, from big business owners to small business owners to, today, African Americans. To mark the beginning of Black History Month, Trump called the African American experience one of unimaginable sacrifice, hard work, and faith in America. But he also used the time to take personal shots at the media, here referencing a mistake by Time magazine Zeke Miller.
They said the statue, the bust of Dr. Martin Luther King was taken out of the office, and it was never even touched. So I think it was a disgrace, but that's the way the press is. Very unfortunate.
He did not mention that Zeke Miller quickly tweeted that the bust had been blocked from his view. It was there. But the president continued today, picking up on an attack on CNN. He spoke to Paris Denard, a Republican strategist who appeared regularly with us here on Here and Now, but also on CNN.
And Paris has done an amazing job in a very hostile CNN community. He's all by himself, and he'll have seven people in Paris, and I'll take Paris over the seven. But I don't watch CNN, so I don't get to see you as much as I do. I don't like watching fake news.
Well, let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, put aside using Black History Month for these personal grievances against the press, Politico reported yesterday that the Trump administration is icing out CNN. And Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, spokespeople, haven't appeared in weeks. What's going on there?
That's quite a put aside you're asking there. But yes, you know, they, if you remember the press conference just a couple of days before inauguration, Donald Trump went out of his way to really sort of a verbally attack Jim Acosta, one of the chief reporters on the political trail for CNN, because of CNN's reporting in this dossier, if you recall, about concerns about his allegedly salacious activity in Russia that they couldn't substantiate, but that nonetheless American intelligence officials took seriously enough that they briefed both then President Obama and then President-elect Trump. Well, you know, Jake Tapper was one of the major bylines on that story. He's one of the main anchors for CNN, and no Trump official has appeared on his Sunday Affairs public talk show, State of the Union, since that the report disclosing the existence of the dossier and the briefing by intelligence officials appealed. It seems as though that Sean Spicer and Reince Priebus and others from the administration are saying, we're not going to give CNN the satisfaction of having us on the air to take questions from them because we don't like their reporting, even though the reporting was accurate.
Well, but let's talk about the relationship that we have been talking about for several weeks now, actually months during the campaign, between the president, now president, and the press, and how to cover this fire hose of news in the last couple of weeks. Historian Heather Cox Richardson wrote on Facebook that immigration and travel ban on Friday that was implemented without consulting lawmakers or most of Trump's cabinet picks is called by historians a shock event. It's meant to create chaos, and chaos ensued at the airports, to further divide a country. And she writes, those responsible for the shock event perform a sleight of hand to achieve their real goal, from which everyone has been distracted. And sure enough, a day later, you had top aide Steve Bannon appointed to a seat on the Security Council, while the press was rushing to the airports to cover protests. Now, that sounds pretty paranoid, but then you have David Frum, the conservative commentator and critic of Trump. Fascinating article The Atlantic released early. Frum says that that civil unrest and the marches, immigration protesters, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, this is what President Trump wants his base to see, and what Frum calls the conservative entertainment outrage complex will assist him in getting it out there. And Frum is implying that the mainstream press is as well. Is the mainstream press assisting the president in his true end?
You know, I think the press has to think about the motivations of people and their actions and how they cover things. But I think the press also has to cover what's occurring. You saw a spontaneous, you know, despite the dark insinuations of some administration officials, really a spontaneous spark of outrage occur in cities across the country in reaction to this this immigration edict affecting these seven predominantly Muslim countries, and the question about what does this say about who we are and how does it reflect us? There is a split screen in terms of how the mainstream media is representing what's occurring and how, say, the Trump-centric media is presenting it. Fox mm-hmm. News, Breitbart, Drudge, certain conservative talk radio shows, InfoWars and the like are really presenting the Trump base with a very different understanding of reality. So yes, the video does become fodder for, oh my gosh, this is what the left does. They, you know, create civil unrest and they want to make us less safe. And yet, you know, meanwhile, Republicans and Democrats, many people across the political spectrum are taking great issue with the implications of these things. I saw one person, I cannot remember who it was, but they described the series of events that have transpired in just these first days of the administration as a kind of mass denial of service. And I think what he was saying was that it was almost like the body politics information streaming was overwhelmed by what the Trump administration is doing. Many people have said Trump's an entertainer. He's dilettante. He's never held a political or elected office before. But what he's doing, whether or not you like it, is quite substantive. And it's sweeping and it's in a variety of areas, almost too much to cover, even as a series of issues raised about Trump and his proposed cabinet would otherwise be major stories themselves.
Well, and we're going to keep covering it. NPR media correspondent David Folgenflik, we'll pick it up again. Thank you.
You bet.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston and Olin College of Engineering, hosting more than 100 employers recruiting from around the world and preparing students by teaching skills such as teaming, communications, and entrepreneurship. Olin.edu.